WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As a species, we've always been curious about our surroundings. We are explorers by nature. We wonder about things we can see from afar and even things we can't see. We've always wondered about the heavens, about what's out there. And one big question has hung over our heads for the longest time. Are we alone in the universe, or is there life out there somewhere on other planets? Well, until very recently, we couldn't prove that there were other planets beyond our own solar systems, but now we can, and it seems that almost every day some scientist is discovering yet another planet orbiting yet another sun in some faraway solar system, and that only amplifies the question, are we alone? Dr. Jayawardena, Ray J for short, and you'll soon understand why, is a professor and Canada research chair in observational astrophysics and author of Strange New Worlds, The Search for Alien Planets and Life Beyond Our Solar System. He joins us for the hour to answer that one terribly unsimple question and more. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Mike.
I should mention that you're at the University of Toronto in Canada, and you're here under the auspices of Gardner-Webb University and their planetarium, the Williams, the Williams Observatory, where you'll be speaking tomorrow at 9, and we'll talk more about that and put a link to it on our website because it's the 2013 regional meeting of the amateur astronomers. Let's begin with that burning question. We'll get into it more deeply as we go through the show, but I just want off of the top of your head, answer, do you believe that there is life elsewhere in the universe?
Well, I'll have to say the odds are pretty darn good because we know of thousands of planetary systems now, and chances are that the vast majority of the couple of 100 billion stars in our galaxy have planets of their own. And our galaxy is just one of many billions and billions in the universe. So if you talk about the odds that there would be only this one little rocky planet circling our sun is the only one to harbor life, that seems unlikely. But it's one thing to speculate, but quite another thing to know for sure.
Well, human beings like things to make sense. We like to try to make sense of things. And it wouldn't make sense, would it, that we would be it in the billions and billions of galaxies and the billions and trillions of stars in those galaxies, many of which have planets orbiting around them in the right place at the right time with the right temperature, that there wouldn't be life somewhere else, right?
That would be quite unlikely and odd, to say the least, if that were the case. Now, we do know, we're starting to find out that planets are extremely common, and we're starting to get a glimpse of that habitable planets might also be common, and that we do know, at least through the solar system and the nearby parts of our galaxy, that the ingredients of life, the molecules that go into making life, seem to be common. So the stuff of life is common, the habitats might well be common, and therefore you would think that life must be too. Now, you know, there's also a big difference between primitive single-cell organisms and the kind of complex life that, you know, human beings like to speculate about or that we see on, you know, Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. So it may turn out to be that life itself is common, but complex technological civilizations may not be, because there are many other factors that go into that beyond astronomy and physics.
In the modern world, most of us, as astronomers will tell you, are star-starved because we look up in the night sky and we don't see very much because of light pollution. That if we turned out all the lights in the world, we would, I think, be astounded by what's up there that we could see with the naked eye. And you, of course, use these fancy telescopes and other equipment to see what's out there. I didn't know until I read about you yesterday that there may be as many as 30 billion planetary systems in the Milky Way galaxy alone.
That's a fairly conservative estimate based on what we know so far. As I said, there are a couple of hundred billion stars, and it's possible maybe, 90% of them, which means more than, 100 billion plus planetary systems in our galaxy alone. So the numbers are truly staggering.
How do we count? How do we know?
Exactly. It's hard to know. So what we do is to take a census of a small number of stars in our galaxy, and the Kepler Space Telescope is doing that right now. It was launched by NASA in 2009, and it's been staring at a little patch of the sky which has about 150,000 stars that are bright enough that it could take extremely precise brightness measurements to see any planets that happen to pass in front of any of those stars. So this is a way to kind of take a sample. 150,000 is quite a lot, but it's not that many out of the, couple of hundred billion, right? But it gives us a sample, and from that we can try to extrapolate to the rest of the galaxy and get a sense of how common different types of planets are.
And you mentioned that there could be, I've forgotten the number now, billions of other galaxies out there. We can't see them.
Well, we can see many of them.
Many is many?
Well, I couldn't quite give you a number off the top of my head, but certainly
thousands,
lots
more.
We can
see millions of galaxies?
If you were to survey the entire sky, absolutely, yeah. So the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, with what's called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, stared at a tiny little postage stamp piece of the sky for a long, long, long time, and looked back at billions of light years away. So through actually not just seeing the galaxies in our neighborhood, but seeing snapshots of galaxies through the history of the universe.
Yeah.
So you really are getting a sense of how common various types of galaxies are, but also how they evolve over time. So we really are getting a glimpse of cosmic history.
When they want to make somebody sound smart, they call them a rocket scientist. And I think they should be using you guys as the barometer, because that just astounds me we've reached the technological level that we can see these things, do these things with these instruments that we have created.
Yeah,
it's astounding. Your book, you say, Strange New Worlds, The Search for Alien Planets and Life Beyond Our Solar System, is about the rapidly unfolding scientific revolution that you say could change the way we see ourselves and our place in the universe. How so?
Well, when Copernicus suggested that the sun was at the center of the solar system, not the Earth, not everything in the universe is revolving around our little world, that was a big change in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think it was even more important when Galileo turned his telescope at the heavens 400 years ago and looked at the moon and saw that the moon was a real world, a place with, valleys and hills and, craters. And he turned his telescope at Jupiter and saw these four little dots, the four biggest moons of Jupiter, which we still call the Galilean moons. And he tracked them night after night, and he could show people through his little telescope that these little dots are actually circling Jupiter. So not everything in the universe is circling around us. So that's the kind of change of perspective that happened 400 years ago. And I think by the discovery of all these other planetary systems, for the first time now, we're kind of getting a good sense of how our own solar system stacks up in the cosmic context, right? So it's sort of the completion of the Copernican Revolution is coming now 400 years later, when we are really getting a sense of, is our little Earth a very common type of planet, or is it a rare world? Might we be alone, or might we be not? And might we have lots of cosmic neighbors? So it's really a very exciting time where, when I started graduate school not that long ago, our solar system was the only one known. And since then, we demoted Pluto, but we've gained, a few thousand other planets beyond our solar system.
Yeah, and you say that astronomers are on the verge of finding alien twins to the Earth, planets that are roughly the size of Earth, with just the right temperatures to sustain liquid water on the surface. In November of 2012, just a few months ago, you said it could happen any day now.
Absolutely. And in particular, this Kepler Space Telescope is following up on a number of candidate planets that are at about the right distance from their star and about the right size, meaning comparable to the size of the Earth, that they could well be rocky planets with the right sort of temperatures to sustain liquid water on their surface. Now, why are we focusing on this? It's because it's the only kind of planet we know, the Earth, namely, that has life. So in a sense, the search for life elsewhere, at least for now, for astronomers, is a search for water. And I'm not saying that necessarily that's the best answer, but it's sort of the best guess we have to go with for now, because we have only one example of a living planet. And I do think it'll be a dramatic day in human history when we have a second example. Because it's very dangerous. We've learned in science and we've learned in planet hunting to generalize from one example. And for life, we only have that one. Mm-hmm. So it would be really probably a surprise the day that we find a second example, because it may not be anything like we imagine it might be.
So you're saying that the life, if we find life elsewhere, it may not be like the life we know.
Well, we think it'll share some common characteristics. It'll be made of elements that we're familiar with in the universe. Most likely, carbon is going to be involved at a fundamental biochemical level. Probably there'll be similarities, but in terms of walking on 2 feet and having 2 eyes and all of the other, physiological characteristics that we depict in movies, probably not.
But even if we find a planet that is the exact twin of the Earth in terms of its distance from its own sun and the fact that it has water and it's the right temperature.
Exactly.
For life, even if we find that planet out there, we will never go there in our lifetimes, one would think.
Most likely, even the nearest examples are going to be too far away for us to physically go.
So how will we know that there is life?
Excellent question. So for one thing, as you said, just finding this candidate planet that could harbor life doesn't mean it has life, right? So we need to find ways of determining to the best we can whether there is life or not. And we think we can use signatures of what we call biosignatures, basically imprints of interesting molecules like oxygen and water and methane and ozone in the spectra of those planets. In other words, we think we can measure something about the atmospheres of these worlds that tell us if there is life on their surface. So even from a distance of tens or hundreds of light years away, we expect to be able to see some imprints. In other words, think of it as remote sensing. Now, we are used to, space craft satellites looking down on Earth and doing remote sensing, right? We depend on it every day for weather forecasts, for daily life. This is sort of remote sensing in the true remote sense.
Yeah, because those satellites that are looking down on us to do weather checks and the temperature of the ocean and whether the ocean has risen or not, sea level has risen or not, can actually see the planet, and they're seeing the planet close up.
Yeah.
We're talking about seeing these planets from, 136 light years away minimum?
Yes, or, well, not necessarily. Some of them could be just 4, 10, 20 light years away, which is still pretty darn far.
And a light year is what? An actual year?
It's how long, how far light travels in 1 year.
Which is how far?
Which is about 6 million miles, if I got that right.
Okay, so they could, these things could be millions and millions. Even a probe would not get there in our lifetime, correct?
No, not with the technology we have.
So everything that you're talking about, the discovery, the probing of these planets is being done by telescopes and radar and light spectrography, if that's the right word.
Spectrometers. Yeah.
How can you tell? I'll tell you what, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to find out how you can tell, how astronomers can tell what's on a foreign body way out in the sky just by the colors that it's pushing off into the telescope. Dr. Ray, say your last name.
Jayawardena.
Okay. Dr. Ray Jayawardena, Ray J for short, is our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and CPCC Corporate and Continuing Education announcing open enrollment for spring classes to advance professional careers in short-term certificate courses. Registration at cpcc.edu/CCE. And Culture and Heritage Museums, the Secret Sisters perform traditional country standards and original songs featured in the Hunger Games tomorrow, 7:30 p.m. at the McKelvey Center. Tickets at chmuseums.org. Speaking of music, thanks to Glee and movies like High School Musical, musical theater has experienced a surge in popularity at the high school level. And to help that along, several years ago, the Jimmy Awards were started, named after Broadway producer and theater owner James Niederlander. It's a national competition that Charlotte took part in for the first time last year. Upcoming, the second annual Bloomy Awards, and we'll talk about them Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the Pentagon lifts the ban on combat roles for women. Secretary Clinton testifies before Congress on the Benghazi attack. And the House passes a short-term debt ceiling extension.
Join the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dr. Ray Jayawardena. Dr. Ray Jayawardena, who is a professor at the University of Toronto in the Canada Research Chair in Observational Astrophysics, also the author of Strange New Worlds, The Search for Alien Planets and Life Beyond Our Solar System. We got a better definition of a light year.
I got that just a little wrong. It's about 6 trillion miles, not 6 million.
So it's far, 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 far away, these planets. The nearest planet is far, far, far away, outside of our own solar system. How can you tell from color what you're looking at?
I know. So as I tell in my book, astronomy is actually quite different from many other sciences in that for the most part, except when we, you know, pick up meteorites like I was involved in doing 2 years ago in Antarctica, normally we have to really rely on a little bit of light coming from a distant star or a galaxy or a planet to tell what's going on. But luckily, these molecules, in particular molecule like oxygen, each atom, each molecule, each element has its own fingerprint in a spectrum. So a spectrum is basically when you spread the light, just like you spread sunlight into a rainbow. Mm-hmm. If you spread the light very widely, against that background, the colors of the rainbow, you see these dark lines, which are absorbed lines due to molecules in the atmosphere of a planet. Mm-hmm. So when a planet passes in front of its star, we can take a spectrum of that and we can see what's in the atmosphere of the planet from what molecules in that atmosphere are absorbing the starlight coming through it.
How do we know we can? How do we know we're not just making an educated guess?
Because we can measure the exact same fingerprint in the lab. You can pass light through, you know, a little chamber of gas and get the exact same spectrum at the exact same set of wavelengths. Mm-hmm. So we have many ways of cross-checking what it is that we're interpreting.
When did we figure all this out?
Well, that's been coming. It's a story I tell in the book. It's been work coming on for the last couple of hundred years. But over time, we've really narrowed down. But the bigger challenge is not the physics of it, not knowing which molecule we're looking at, but the biology of it, which is what does that mean? Like, even if there is oxygen, does that guarantee life? Not really, because there are non-biological ways of producing oxygen. So we think what we need is to have multiple of these biosignatures, several different interesting biology-related molecules being present at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge. It's interpreting what that means for life or not. But also, even if, let's say, you've got these, you know, fingerprints measured from a distance and you're quite confident that the conditions are right, that there might even be, you know, indications of life, you still don't know whether you're looking at, you know, slime or civilization, right? Because you just know it's life. But
and that slime could be civilization in another life form, right?
Who knows?
You are,
for example, on Earth, you know, cow dung is a strong source of methane,
uh-huh.
Right? So if you detect methane, what does that mean? What are you looking at?
Right. You are a planet hunter. That's what you call yourself. Are all astronomers planet hunters, or are you a subset of astronomers?
It's a subset. Astronomy, you know, covers everything from our sort of immediate neighborhood within the solar system to the far reaches of the universe. So everybody from sort of, you know, some people do cosmology, right, the kind of the large-scale origin and evolution and structure of the universe. Some people work on planets in our own solar system. So there's a full range of distances to play with. And planet hunting just has become a very exciting subfield of astronomy just in the last 20 years.
Is that because just in the last 20 years we've actually been able to accomplish it?
Exactly. It's been a long time coming. For thousands of years, people speculated about planets around other stars. And for almost 100 years, people tried to find them, tried to detect them. But planets are so incredibly faint compared to the stars that they circle. If you were to go to the nearest star and look back at our solar system, the Earth would be several hundred million times fainter than the Sun. What that means is that you're trying to look for a little faint ember next to a bright searchlight from a mile away. That means the faint ember, the Earth, would be completely lost in the glare of the Sun, which makes it extremely difficult to find planets from a distance. Mm. That's why it's taken us so long, and astronomers have had to be clever and develop other techniques, like measuring the wobble of a star that is due to the gravitational tug of a planet circling it, or trying to catch a planet in transit, a planet that passes in front of the star and dims the star just a tiny bit for just a few hours, but doing so every time the planet passes in front, in its orbit.
But how do you know it's a planet in that solar system that's passing in front of that star? How do you know it's not some other heavenly object, some asteroid that's so far out in space that we don't know that it's there, but it's passing in front of a star?
It's good to challenge these assumptions, and we do our best to independently verify through multiple techniques. So, for example, the same exact star that has a transiting planet, a planet that is dimming it every once in its orbit, if you could also measure the wobble and the two agree that the orbits you get are exactly have the exact same period, both from the transit method and the wobble method, that gives you corroboration, that gives you, additional support that your interpretation is correct. And then if you can actually measure something about the atmosphere of this world, which tells you, its temperature. I mean, one of the things that amazes me to this day is, something that we do in my research group. I had a graduate student who finished a thesis last year whose, thesis consisted of measuring the dayside temperature of distant worlds with just doing infrared brightness measurements with a telescope in Hawaii. This guy, as a graduate student, he's doing true remote sensing. He's taking measure of a dayside of a planet that we can't otherwise see.
This is mind-boggling to me, I guess, and I would imagine to some of our listeners who don't follow this as carefully as you do. Is it mind-boggling to you?
Well, it's certainly. Exciting, and it's certainly on a daily basis. It doesn't get dull. Let me put it that way. It's certainly I go to work excited to see what my students and postdocs have accomplished. The previous day. I mean, it moves at such a pace too. Mm-hmm. That's the other part that's very exciting, in how far we've come in 20 years, going from knowing about one solar system to the point now that, one more planet isn't news anymore. I mean, astronomers announce planets by the hundreds now.
Right.
Because, one more doesn't really mean anything unless it's a particularly special world that's, similar to the Earth.
What has driven this explosion of ability to see these things and the technology that you use in the last 20 years?
So one is obviously technology. We've got better capabilities in terms of bigger telescopes, but also instrumentation that's a lot more sophisticated at measuring, for example, with much greater precision, the wobble of a star. These wobbles are tiny little wobbles, and you need to measure the velocity of a star extremely precisely to know what's going on. And then also space telescopes like Kepler, where from the Earth, because of the effect of the Earth's own atmosphere, it's very difficult to make extremely precise measurements of the brightness of a star, not at the level that you need to detect an exo-Earth. Mm. You need to measure the brightness of a star to about one part in 10,000. And that's pretty much impossible to do from the ground. So having a telescope in space really helped.
How much of the equipment that you rely on to do what it is that you do, be they telescopes on Earth or telescopes in space or other equipment that you need to do your job, was supplied by governments versus private industry versus universities, which I guess are ex officio government organizations to a certain degree. Some of them are, at least. Where does the money come from, I guess, is the bottom line.
Well, a lot of basic science, not just astronomy, is publicly funded. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason for that is, you know, it's such long-term efforts that it's difficult to see within a week or a month or a quarter or a year what practical benefit that you get. That said, there have been private benefactors, foundations that have funded some of the biggest telescopes on Earth, like the twin Keck telescopes in Hawaii were largely funded by a private foundation. Mm-hmm. Now, public money has gone into building instruments for them that astronomers use at the back end of the telescope. So it's a combination, and a lot of us are driven by our curiosity. So the greatest privilege of my job is that I get to be curiosity driven, that I get to ask a question and try to answer it. And you know, basic science does often lead to practical benefits. Some of the technologies that we use, for example, infrared detection instruments, mm-hmm. Have crossover benefits. They've gone into, for example, medical imaging, both the actual detectors, but also the software for image analysis has been used in other fields like medical imaging now.
Yeah, we did a program on this about 2 or 3 years ago where what used to be a box the size of a room to do what you do has been boiled down to a box that literally is a shoebox, and it's applied in medical technology, yes, which has benefited people all over the world. And that, I guess that's what I'm getting at. Because I'm a big proponent of the space program, always have been, always will be. And people that I've talked to, some people have a real trouble trying to see what the value in that is. Why would we want to land men on the moon? Why do we care about the Mars rover? Why do we care about what you do? If we can't ever get to those planets, we can never meet any life forms that are there, and they're not a threat to us if we find them because they're too far away to get to us, why do we care?
Well, first of all, as human beings, we're curious and we want to know the answer. And if you're only putting a tiny bit of your resources into exploring the world and the universe around us, I think that's worth every penny, even if you don't count all these practical benefits, right? And the practical benefits are real, and they've been shown over and over again throughout history that being curiosity driven does open up new areas of understanding, just understanding materials around in our world that really open up. I mean, when people first discovered, in some sense, electricity in the lab, the connection between magnetism and electricity, somebody asked, of what use is this? And look around in the studio now, without electricity, what would we be doing? Right? So, and we wouldn't have known that if you didn't investigate the world around us, that there is this property called electricity that you could harness someday. It doesn't happen overnight. And the scientists at the time answered, well, of what use is this? He said, well, someday you can tax it, right? and that's what, so it does lead to real practical benefits. But I think, I have to be honest, I'm driven personally by the curiosity. And then there's also the other spillover benefit. I grew up in Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. Developing country with, even today, not a single professional astronomer. I was inspired by the Apollo program, which ended, which I was born in 1971, so I wasn't even aware of it when it happened. But just the idea that people could walk on the moon was just so astounding to me as a kid. You couldn't help but be inspired. It just sort of there's the inspiration aspect, especially for kids and drawing people into science and technology careers, but also just being science being part of culture and an integral part of what makes us human.
We've been talking about planets and finding planets and how many planets we've found. Let's define the word. What exactly is a planet?
Now you're walking into a controversial area, as you might.
Yeah, because Pluto used to be one.
I know, exactly. So it's a changing definition because of all these incredible discoveries, right? We used to have this nice little pigeonhole that we could, put a planet into, and that pigeonhole has gotten all messed up because at both ends. And so the International Astronomical Union voted on the definition of a planet, at least drawing a line at the bottom end of it, saying Pluto is too little to be called a planet, and they created a new category called dwarf planets. And there are a few of them and a growing number of them in our own solar system. So the problem was just that astronomers started discovering other icy bodies in the outskirts of our own solar system that were about the size of Pluto. So you either had to elevate them into, you know, planethood, and then, you know, school children will someday have to learn the names of 50 planets instead of 9, or they could, you know, make it a little simpler by dropping one of them and calling Pluto a dwarf planet. That's what we did. Now, the definition hasn't even been clarified that well at the high end. Like, what's too massive to be a planet?
Yeah.
Because some of these worlds that we're discovering around other stars kind of, you know, push the limits of what we might traditionally think of as a planet.
So they're bigger than Jupiter.
They're several times heftier than Jupiter. So would you draw a line somewhere there, say, well, that might not have formed like Jupiter did?
So it just occurred to me. I've always actually wondered about this, I suppose. We have these planets in our solar system, and they're all different sizes, and they're all different distances from our sun. And yet you would think that maybe the largest planet, because it's heavier, would either be closest to the sun or farthest away from the sun because it's got its own gravity and it's moved out.
Yeah.
And since all these planets were born from the sun, if I'm not mistaken, why do we have all these different sizes in different places? Why aren't they small to large or large to small?
Oh, you're getting at an interesting issue, which is we were used to thinking of these in our own solar system, these little rocky worlds close to the sun and big gas giants further out.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was explained by the fact that very close to the sun, it was too hot in the protoplanetary disk, the disk of dust and gas out of which our planets formed. It was too hot for these gaseous bodies to condense out very close to the star. But further out, they could build up, and in particular, you could have a lot more ice, and therefore there was a lot more material out of which to build a core of a planet, which could get massive enough to attract a gigantic envelope of gas. Now, this whole picture has been turned upside down by the discoveries of planets around other stars, because the very first planet to be discovered around another star, around another normal star, was a Jupiter-like gas giant, but one that was circling its star every 4 days. So instead of Jupiter taking 12 years to go around the sun, here was an alien Jupiter that was going around its sun every 4 days.
Mm.
What does that mean? That means that planet was incredibly close to that star. How did it get there? And the best, you know, explanation we have is that it didn't form there. It formed further out and migrated inwards, kind of surfed along the protoplanetary disk and migrated inwards and parked itself in this really tight orbit around its star. So the general picture that's emerging from discoveries of other solar systems is that the early days of planet formation are a lot more dynamic and chaotic than we had imagined just from our solar system. Planets, once they're born, move around. They might actually play slingshot games with their siblings.
Mm.
Some might get hurled out and others might get hurled in. And some might actually fall right into the star in the early days.
We have actually been witness now, right, to the birth of planets.
In the sense that that's one of the things I started doing as a graduate student was we look at stars at different ages with our telescopes, and we can take snapshots of different stars at different ages. So we can look at very young stars when they are surrounded by these disks of material. We can look at them a little bit later and see those disks evolving into planets. So we can at least put the story together by a set of these snapshots.
Dr. Jade Jayavardhana, our guest today from the University of Toronto and the author of Strange New Worlds, The Search for Alien Planets and Life Beyond Our Own Solar System. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, specializing in buying fine diamonds and estate jewelry. Donald Hack Diamonds across from South Park Mall or at DonaldHack.com. It's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes. A panel of journalists joins Diane for an analysis of the week's top domestic news stories. The Pentagon lifting the ban on combat roles for women. Secretary Clinton testifying before Congress in the Benghazi attack. And the House passing a short-term debt ceiling extension. Those are just some of the stories in the first hour of the International Hour at 11. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
There's a new assault weapons ban to consider. That's a phrase a lot of gun owners don't care for, much less how they're described.
Gun people aren't oblivious to things. You know, we're not these Neanderthals, you know, just trying to make a buck.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, talking gun control at the shooting range, next time on Marketplace. Today's business news as well, it's from APM, American Public Media.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Dr. Ray Jayawardena, Ray J for short, from the University of Toronto and the Canada Research Chair in Observational Astrophysics. He's been described by Wired Magazine as a rock star astronomer. And Dr. Don Olive is with us also in the studio, professor of physics and astronomy at Gardner-Webb University. Because Dr. Jayawardena is speaking there tomorrow as part of the 2013 Regional Meeting of Amateur Astronomers. Obviously, you latched on to him because he's a rock star.
Well, absolutely.
In what way is he a rock star?
You walk into an astronomy meeting, like an American Astronomical Society meeting, and everyone knows Ray J, as we call him. He's a sought-after speaker. He's award-winning writer. He's a catch for us at Gardner-Webb.
And tomorrow he's speaking about what?
He's speaking on this subject. He's speaking at the 20th annual Regional Meeting of Amateur Astronomers. It's a meeting we have every year. It brings astronomers from about a 5-state area into Gardner-Webb.
That article in Wired magazine was written in 2002, and at the time, it was about your trying to hone in on what would have been the first photograph ever taken of a planet outside our solar system. I take it you were able to do that.
Yeah, now astronomers got pictures of a few different planets circling other suns. So instead of all these indirect methods of just the measuring the wobble of a star or the dimming of a star, now we have a few examples we can point to on a picture and say, here is a planet. Now, the only ones we have so far are pretty massive. They're several times heftier than Jupiter. So so this is really the tip of the iceberg. The biggest, the hottest, youngest are the planets that are easiest to directly take pictures of, and that's what we've got.
How do we know that they're several times heftier than Jupiter? How do we know they're just not closer? I mean, you can look at buildings in downtown Charlotte. If you look at the skyline, you would think that the Wachovia Tower and maybe even the Duke Power Tower are taller than the Bank of America Tower. They are not.
Yeah.
But optically, they look to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you know?
How do we know? To know the mass of a planet, you have to know the mass of the star. So we need to first measure what that is. And we can actually measure, in some cases, the motion of the planet around the star. So let me tell you about one particular system where four planets have been imaged circling the same star. Just over 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, you can see these little dots on your photograph moving around the star. So you're catching a fraction of their orbit around that star. So just simply using Newton's laws of gravity, you can put some constraint on the mass of that system. So it's getting to the point that you can actually have fairly reliable estimates of their masses. So that's how that's sort of one of the simpler examples where we could tell how massive one of these planets is.
In 1998, you made the cover of Newsweek, in part because you captured what has been described as a startlingly clear image of a young adult star in the process of planet formation. I'm just curious how that, when that moment occurred in your professional life, what that felt like.
Well, I was a graduate student, and it was very exciting. It was the first observing run in Chile for my thesis work, and we were using a new mid-infrared camera that my collaborators at the University of Florida had developed, and we took it down there. We put it on the back of the telescope, and we had a few bad nights of cloudy weather, and finally started to clear up just a little bit in the middle of the night, and among the list of stars that I was going to target, in this particular one, because of its age and it was better known, better established than the others, I wanted to point at it. And so, just watching, we took a long exposure photograph, and you could sort of see this disk image building up on the computer screen over, so say, 20 minutes or so. And it was just astounding, because immediately that was an example, a rare example in science, when you knew immediately what it was. And that was very exciting. And I remember in the morning, we continued to observe it. We took observations at different wavelengths. In the morning, I had trouble going to sleep.
Yeah.
So one of my colleagues there and me, we made a nice image of it and emailed it to my advisor in Boston. And I couldn't go to sleep. I sort of, waited till he came to office in the morning and called him up and said, well, did you see that? because it was just so exciting. Part of it was because I was young.
You know,
I was easily excitable. But part of it was genuinely sort of fun and exciting to have something, that happened on such a time, right on the spot.
So I have to ask,
yeah,
was that luck or was that a combination of knowledge and skill, knowing when and where to look and what you were looking for?
It's both. I mean, it was definitely, we had a set of stars that we were going to look at. So in that sense, we had some idea of what we were looking for and we were targeting stars of a certain age. But it was certainly luck in that particular one happened to be a disk that is sort of seen close to edge on and therefore easier to take a picture of. So it was luck in that sense too. So it was definitely a combination. And as it happens, you can tell that this was also because of new technology, because that same exact disk was imaged by another team of astronomers in Hawaii, without being known to us, completely independently. So we found out a couple of weeks later that about each other's finding, and we had a joint press conference at the NASA headquarters in Washington. So you could tell that multiple astronomers were going after the same thing, in part because technology had finally enabled us to do that. Right, it's something we would have liked to do, but finally we could actually do it.
And when you say technology, are you talking about computers, or are you talking about computers having been able, the use of computers in the work that you do, or the fact that computers have made it possible to develop better instruments in other ways?
Well, in this particular case, it was the technology of infrared detectors, mm-hmm, that are allowing us to take photographs at longer wavelengths than we could. So this is light that's much longer wavelength than our eyes can perceive. So you're basically measuring the heat radiation from dust particles in this disk. So it was technology in terms of the electronics, the detectors. Mm-hmm. But now there are other cases, like we were talking a minute ago, about direct images of other planets around other stars. Those have been made possible by a combination of optics, advanced optics, but also computing, because we use these technology called adaptive optics, where we have a secondary mirror inside the telescope that changes shape many times a second because of little motors in the back side of that mirror that pushes and pulls. And where computers come in is that we need to be able to program a loop where you measure the turbulence of the Earth's atmosphere and correct for it many times a second. So you have to do very fast computing to tell the mirror what shape to take in the next fraction of a second. So this is a way to kind of get much clearer, much sharper images with ground-based telescopes than we could otherwise by correcting for the blurring due to the Earth's atmosphere.
Just that technology is astounding.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And that's a technology that, again, going back to practical applications, that's also used now for correcting vision. So it's something that's used in practical human use, mm-hmm, as well as for science.
People, I would think, listening to us, and I would have thought till I read about this yesterday, that people like you, who are so advanced in your field and so important to the field of astronomy, all you do is sit at these computer terminals or in these planetariums or what do you call observatories, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whatever you want to, and look through the telescope. But that is not the case.
Not quite.
There are a lot more astronomers than there are telescopes.
Absolutely. So we have to compete for time on the big telescopes in the world. So twice a year we put in proposals describing, you know, what scientific question we want to answer and how we plan to do that, which particular set of stars or galaxies or, you know, objects we're going to be looking at what wavelengths and which instrument and how we're going to. So we have to justify it to our own colleagues that they should give us, you know, allocate a night or two or four on one of these telescopes.
So they decide that what you want to do is worth letting you do with their telescope. And so they book you on December 12th, 2012 from 7 p.m. with sunset, 7 p.m. to sunrise the next day. And it turns out to be cloudy or rainy.
I've been there.
So what does that mean? What happens to that night?
Well, it's gone? That used to be the case, and it is to some extent still the case, that and you're just out of luck. You go all the way to Chile, and you're now the one night you got on a 8-meter telescope, you know, it turns out to be cloudy. So you just go back home and, you know, reapply. That model is changing a little bit now, especially with these big telescopes, because the time on them is so precious that now more and more they're operated in what's called service mode, where we send in these proposals, which get approved, and then staff astronomers there carry out the observations for us and send us the data. So that way they can optimize better, you know, to do your project in the weather conditions that's best for that project.
But you have
project.
To be – don't you have to do it at a certain time given where the planet happens to be at a certain time of the year from our point of view?
Well, certain part of the year. It's most things except, say, transit events are not that narrow a window. But the astronomers there will carry it out for you. So it sort of reduces, you know, the amount of travel you have to do and increases your chances of getting good weather or getting data instead of being clouded out. So that's a little bit like using a space telescope where you send, you know, you upload your commands and you get the data back. You're not physically at the telescope taking the data. So that's the model is changing a little bit. We still do go to some telescopes and some observatories in remote places like Hawaii and Chile. More and more I send students and postdocs now, and you know, I go myself a couple of times a year. It's still a lot of fun, and it still kind of really brings you. You were talking before about how we disconnected from the night sky because of all the city lights. It's still remarkable to just stand on, you know, on a peak in the Andes Mountains in Chile and just look up at the night sky with your own eyes, and just you see the Milky Way arching across the night sky with thousands of stars you can see with your own eyes. It's still quite a stirring, you know, a sensation. It's just, you know, you sort of realize, why am I here? Why am I doing this?
How endangered are we of losing the ability to do that, even in these remote locations?
It is certainly challenging because as civilization spreads, for example, radio telescopes have to be put in more and more remote locations.
Yeah.
Some of these places have been quite aware and considerate of the value of these remote sites for astronomy. So they're trying to protect them from bright lights nearby. Arizona, for example, in the U.S. has been quite sensitive to this issue of light pollution and many other localities. But it's also kind of it's a strange world we live in the sense that, you know, in one sense we don't see our night sky, but at the same time now with our iPad you can call up, you know, beautiful images on the surface of Mars taken with a remote rover. So it's sort of, you know, it's a weird disconnect. In one sense we're disconnected, but in another sense,
yeah,
a lot of this science is a lot more accessible to us now than it's ever been in the history of humankind.
Why do we still rely on Earth-based telescopes that have to contend with atmospheric pollution and distortions and cloud cover, et cetera, when we have the Kepler Space Telescope and we have the Hubble Space Telescope and other space? There are lots of – I didn't know this.
Yeah.
There are lots of telescopes up there.
In space. But because the biggest telescopes we still have are on Earth – and it's a lot.
Is that because you can't get them up?
It's a hell of a lot more expensive to get them up into space than to build them on Earth. And there's a lot of valuable science we can do from the Earth that doesn't require us to be in space.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we're sensitive to doing our science with the, you know, without spending more money than absolutely necessary.
I would think most people have seen these magnificent photographs that have come back of outer space from
Hubble,
the Hubble. They're stunningly beautiful. They're works of art.
They really are.
But what does that tell you as an astronomer? What are you seeing in those pictures, aside from what we're seeing, which is just gorgeousness?
Yeah. So the pictures are valuable because from the colors, you learn something about them. You learn something about the structure, the shape. But as I was discussing earlier, the spectra, spreading this light into, you know, all its glory in all its wavelengths, really gives us a lot more physical information about temperatures, about motions, about chemical composition. So we learn a lot more from light than just looking at a pretty picture. As important as pretty pictures are, there's a lot more measurements that we can do with telescopes, with the modern instruments that analyze light.
This is almost a semi-religious question, and I don't want to put you on the spot about this, but all this stuff is out there, unfathomable amounts of it, doing its thing. Why?
Why is the universe there?
Yeah, what's it doing? What's the point?
In some sense, you know, somebody once said that we are universe's way of knowing itself, right? So in the sense that we are, we are literally made of stardust. We're literally made, the elements in our body, the carbon in our bodies, the iron in our blood, the oxygen we breathe, was all of those elements were cooked inside stars that are long dead and gone. So we are intimately connected to the rest of the universe. I can't directly answer your question why, but it's certainly, we're not separate from it. We're intimately connected in our makeup, but we sort of, you know, it's intimately sort of the search for what's out there is also a search for our own origins and our own place in the cosmic scheme of things.
We are stardust, we are golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. Isn't that Crosby, Stills, and Nash? I think it is. Dr. Ray Jayawardena, Ray J for short, professor at the University of Toronto and the author of Strange New Worlds, The Search for Alien Planets and Life Beyond Our Solar System. He speaks tomorrow at the 2013 regional meeting of the Amateur Astronomers, a.k.a. Bulby Fest or Bob Fest, at 9 o'clock in the morning at Gardner Webb University. Information about that on our website. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The producer is Tim Ross. The associate producer is Aaron Kiever. And our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, up